There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back for another episode of the 45th Podcast. This is Susan Simpson, and I'm here this week with Siraj and Tom. Hey, guys.
Hey, how you doing?
Good to be with you.
Yeah, for once we have everyone in D.C.
Yeah, for once, yeah.
So, y'all have been on the show before, but tell everyone again what your background is and...
Sure, so I'll go first. Siraj Hashmi, assistant editor with Red Alert Politics. We're a conservative millennial publication affiliated with the Washington Examiner and the Weekly Standard.
This is Tom Rogan, commentary writer for the Washington Examiner, so I work with Siraj.
Unfortunately, he works with me.
Yeah.
So, it's been another week of the usual dumpster fires. In some ways, a little bit quieter than previous weeks have been. I don't know how y'all felt about it.
There's no winners, unfortunately, because, you know, what we're...
Are there ever?
Well, sometimes there are politically. This is just the... I mean, what we saw in Niger with the ambush of... nine people who were killed, four of them which were American military personnel. Pulling up the news.
I thought there was only one soldier from.
No, there were four. There were four Americans. So
yeah, four Americans, but one from Niger.
Well, it's hard to tell because the reports are pretty inconsistent and all over the place. But it does seem as if there were more Nigerian deaths than just one. So to back up, although I'm sure everyone has heard the news by now, this actually was not this week. This was on October 4th that it happened. And there was an attack on an American team of troops in the country of Niger in West Africa, and four Americans were killed. There was sort of a weird two-week gap where nothing really was said about it. We knew it happened. There were a few reports on what went down, but there was kind of this weird quiet, and I guess there kind of still is in some ways.
Right, and a lot of it had to do with the reports coming from when Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, who... was killed in action during that ambush. The report coming from Congresswoman Frederica Wilson in Miami, basically receiving the remains, his wife, now widow, Maisha Johnson.
Well, actually, let's back up a bit. Before we get to that, let's go into the background some more.
Okay, so why don't you get into that?
I mean, like a lot of people, I didn't know we had troops in Niger. I don't know if this is on your radars at all.
I mean, I knew we had troops in Nigeria, so... By proximity, I can imagine that we would, I mean, we were fighting Boko Haram and an Islamic State affiliate, but I mean, it doesn't surprise me that we had troops in Niger, but I did not realize that the operation extended to that part of the region.
Yeah, and it's still not really clear what was going on there. What we know, I think we know now, is that there was a team of like Green Berets and support troops on the northern border with Mali of Green Berets, essentially. In the town of Tongo Tongo. And there's been a lot of statements I've seen about what they were doing there. It's a support mission, a training mission, or as Kelly said today, to teach them to respect human rights or something like that.
Yeah, I think they were meeting with a local tribe. Is that what it was?
Yeah, and that's what we know for sure. There was a meeting with tribal elders in this town a little bit south of the border. They'd apparently done almost not quite 30 missions like this over the past 6 months. So it was a pretty regular occurrence. And they were there not in a combat capacity. They were in light trucks.
And it's something very similar we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq, where you have a platoon meet with the local tribe with their leaders and basically either try to get intel or you try to basically bridge the gap and build a relationship with them so that you can provide that open communication where they are providing intel.
Yeah, but a bit different in that in this case, they apparently did not suspect that there could actually be sort of a combat issue there. I saw one report on this, and I haven't seen it since, is that apparently people who were up there, soldiers who survived, reported that they thought that the villagers were in on the attack and that they were stalling the troops to wait for the probably ISIS-affiliated fighters to arrive.
You know, there has been that report, and I think, obviously that'll be looked into. But I think the ultimate point here is that, I mean, this is... The Green Berets, special forces groups, they tend to operate in 12-person teams behind enemy lines, building, cultivating relationship with guerrilla forces, or building up the apparatus of a state force, in this case, the military of Niger, to be able to deal with internal threats. But most of the time, these kind of activities go on behind the scenes, and there's, you know, actually not nearly as much combat as people might expect, even though it has, you know, the nomenclature of special forces. But, you know, sometimes because of the nature of the work, you are going to have these incidents. I just tend to think, you know, this is Americans don't really know that this goes on all the time. And I hope we don't respond to this by making it harder for Green Berets to do what they do, because kind of uniquely to American military power, they do operate with a very small footprint without the kind of apparatus and structures that would otherwise limit their ability to do their job. Risk is part of the game.
It's still, again, we're still sort of putting the other pieces here about what actually happened. But the report seemed to agree that there was about 50 militants, probably ISIS affiliated, like I said, maybe Al-Qaeda, I've seen a few places. And essentially half the troops were inside talking to the elders, half were out guarding these little pickup trucks when the attack happened. They've described it as like overwhelming force, well coordinated. And the initial attack, it seems like all the Americans were able to get to the trucks and start driving away. What happened though, there was a second larger attack. And from reports, it looks like all the Americans may have been killed. It had not been for the French, actually, that were able to provide air support within half an hour. As a military spokesperson said, this was not expected. Had we anticipated this sort of attack, we absolutely would have devoted more resources to it to reduce the risk. And that's something we're looking at right now. Again, apparently it was a very large battle scene. Like, as far as I can tell, they were actually driving, and it was like car-to-car combat.
I unfortunately don't know nearly as much as what's being reported.
Oh, that the French were there? Yeah. So what we know is that the French, and again, half an hour, they have jets on the scene. However, they couldn't actually, they'd have no permission from local government to attack or use force. So what they did is they did sort of low flybys, which scattered the attackers. But they didn't actually fire on them. They couldn't.
It was more of a spook tactic to try to get them to disperse.
And it worked, luckily. But what happened during at some point, probably during the second attack, is three U.S. troops were killed and one went missing.
And that was David Johnson who went missing, right?
Mm-hmm. He was not a Green Beret. He was a truck mechanic. Two of the deceased were sort of traditional Green Beret. But LaDavid Johnson was a mechanic, and Jeremiah Johnson was a chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear specialist. Just felt awful. And LaDavid Johnson went missing, was not recovered for apparently 48 hours. And it's very unclear what happened. No one seems to know how he went missing or what happened to him after he went missing. And it seems like there's a good chance he was still alive when the evac happened.
I see.
There was, I had actually, a source told me about 36 hours before it came out that one of them was missing. And the expectation was that he was either hiding or had been captured by the aggressor force. So that's why, you know, it wasn't really reported on.
Yeah. And unfortunately, they found him. Actually, the Nigerian troops found him, again, about 2 days later.
I do think it's noticeable, though, that there was a chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear specialist there, which suggests maybe this was targeted at either Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which are in Mali, you know, Boko Haram. Well, Al-Qaeda especially have tried to develop chemical and biological weapons before, so maybe that's part of what's going on here, is that there was some kind of overarching mission to deal with those capabilities. And that would explain, I think, why White House Chief of Staff John Kelly yesterday, you know, said that he's not letting on nearly as much as he knows, and, you know, the government does not want to talk about that issue because of how sensitive those weapons are.
So, Susan, how long have we been running for the 45th now? It's been how many months now?
It's been since March, so half a year.
Half a year. And you know what? It's been a lot of work because it is your own business. But what do you think? Has it been hard?
It's great. I find it really rewarding. mean, it's our own business. We're responsible for everything. And it's been really fun to see it grow and watch the podcast expand its audience.
You're right. And the thing about owning your own business, I mean, there's so much freedom in it. I practiced law for a long time, and I worked in a firm, and then I had my own practice, and there was nothing like it. And the financial freedom of having your own business, a lot of people dream about that. So this week, we actually have a sponsor that can help make that dream come true for a lot of folks. You know what I'm talking about?
UPS.
Talking about UPS, that's right. People might not know it, but the UPS store has over 35 years of franchising experience, and it was just ranked number 4 of the top franchises to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. So number 4 out of 500. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I had no idea they're a franchise at all.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. But, you know, and I see them everywhere. In fact, I was just at a UPS store 2 days ago returning some baby items that went unused, didn't quite work out for me. So they're very convenient. They're all over the place. But, yeah, people can own them. And, you know, it gives you financial freedom. You can be your own boss, have more control of your time. And, you know, the UPS, this is not like some name brand that nobody's heard of. This is an institution that people know about, right? They've got like a worldwide reputation.
Stores are available in large and small markets across the country, and their franchising experts will help you find a location that's just right. Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans.
So the time to promote yourself to business owner is now. There's just no need to wait for this to happen. I mean, like, you can own your own franchise. Visit the UPS store franchising.com/45 to get started today. Once again, it's the UPS store franchising.com/45 to get started today.
So, again, there were apparently 2 Americans were also seriously injured, but they're expected to recover. All gunshot injuries. There was no IEDs or anything. It was small arm fire, machine guns. And apparently there's also reports that there's possibly actually a French troop with the Americans, unclear, as well as the fact that the Nigerian forces were sort of special troops from the Security Intelligence Battalion, not your run-of-the-mill soldier. And there's also been reports that the French team, or French team in the area, had been attacked just days before the assault that never got reported to the Americans. Although that, again, there's so much out there right now, it's hard to see what's true. I don't know if you've heard about that, Tom.
I haven't heard about anything really about that. I mean, the French have been very active. They have pretty significant presence in Mali and doing a lot of this counterterrorism stuff. The US has provided a lot of intelligence support traditionally and let the French sort of take the lead. But you know, one positive of this, I suspect, is that Macron and Trump will, you know, they'll probably set up more of a fusion center where French and U.S. forces work more closely together so that they can collaborate.
Yeah, I did see the reports where the French apparently were not impressed or not pleased at all with the way Americans dressed this without actually telling them ahead of time.
Yeah, well, I mean, the French do the same thing. It's but that stuff is, you know, it's bureaucratic. It's stupid. There's no excuse for it. So they both sides need to be more collaborative going forwards.
Especially since the French had the actual air support and we didn't. So
right, of course.
And that's where another sort of side story in this whole mess came from. So a French helicopter was able to actually evac the injured Americans, but the men who were killed in action were recovered later by a private military contractor. The contractors in place were only required to be ready to sort of get in action within 3 hours to be notified. And that's when the private contractor was able to fly in and retrieve the bodies of the killed in action. And that's where the Trump controversy starts. Apparently, the very next day, there was a statement that was drafted about this incident. For whatever reason, and it doesn't seem like anyone seems to know why, it was never released.
So what was the statement?
I haven't seen it. Apparently, CNN was reporting on it that there was one drafted, and kind of what you'd expect, sort of a generic like statement of the basics about what happened. Nothing controversial or even that informative, but just a sort of boilerplate. Here's what happened. Here's what we know. Here's what's going on.
So beyond that, so the Trump controversy starts with this statement
press conference.
That was never released. So
and so someone at a press conference, the media asked Trump, why haven't you said anything about this event? And here's how he responded.
Why haven't we heard anything from you so far about the soldiers that were killed in Niger? And what do you have to say about
this? I've written them personal letters. They've been sent or they're going out tonight, but they were written during the weekend. I will, at some point during the period of time, call the parents and the families, because I have done that traditionally. I felt very, very badly about that. I always feel badly. It's the toughest calls I have to make are the calls where this happens. Soldiers are killed. It's a very difficult thing. Now, it gets to a point where, you know, you make four or five of them in one day. It's a very, very tough day. For me, that's by far the toughest. So the traditional way, if you look at President Obama and other presidents, most of them didn't make calls. A lot of them didn't make calls. I like to call when it's appropriate, when I think I'm able to do it. They have made the ultimate sacrifice. So generally, I would say that I like to call. I'm going to be calling them. I want a little time to pass. I'm going to be calling them. I have, as you know, since I've been president, I have. But in addition, I actually wrote letters individually to the soldiers we're talking about, and they're going to be going out either today or tomorrow.
So what were your thoughts on Trump's answer there?
Well, you know, I think he, again, there's clearly something else going on behind the scenes that is motivating him to want to stay away from this. I don't think it's simply one of Trump's sort of weird things. I think there's a broader context to it.
So you do, okay, so I've been wondering that, but it's so hard to tell because he does just do weird things. So how do you tell the difference? But it's,
I think by, you know, John Kelly's, you know, comments, by the fact that we're, you know, the CBRN chemical, you know, specialist there, the broader context of, you know, the Johnson going missing, all that stuff speaks to a sort of broader or deeper situation that we're not yet aware of. And so, you know, I think it's going to be, we're going to find out. I think we just, at this moment, we don't know. But I suspect strongly that Trump is not just playing little games here, because he does seem to have, you know, he keeps referring to his, you know, to Mattis and McMaster and Kelly as his generals. And, you know, I think he has this kind of desire.
My generals.
Loved by the military. And, you know, why wouldn't he tweet or even send out, you know, a tweet? So, you know, it's, you know, I think in the next few days it'll become a lot more clear.
Yeah. But of course, his go-to was like not to answer the question, it was to pivot and to start making the story about, just tell a blatant lie about Obama and previous presidents and to claim that they didn't contact those killed in action, which again, no president has ever contacted, like, they don't contact every soldier or troop killed in action. Like some years that's impossible. And again, not appropriate in all cases. So that's not to say they should, but they did. There are times they did do that. And it's a bizarre lie for him to come up with. And he actually, for once, the reporters did fact check him, and he kind of backpedaled. And here was his response when questioned again.
Earlier you said that President Obama never called the families of fallen soldiers. How can you make that claim?
I don't know if he did. No. I was told that he didn't often, and a lot of presidents don't. They write letters. I do, excuse me, Peter, I do a combination of both. Sometimes it's a very difficult thing to do, but I do a combination of both. President Obama, I think, probably did sometimes, and maybe sometimes he didn't. I don't know. That's what I was told. All I can do is ask my generals. Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything. But I like the combination of, I like when I can, the combination of a call and also a letter.
And that's when John Kelly, unfortunately, got brought into this whole mess. And Trump told the reporters they should ask him whether Obama called.
Obviously, that's when you politicize the death of any soldier, it's bound to get ugly. And I think Trump definitely handled this situation poorly. I don't think he obviously didn't need to bring in what previous presidents did. And then I think Kelly, in his response in front of the media, he said, you know, not all presidents, you know, call, but all presidents send letters. And so for Kelly, he even said it himself, he did not get a call from President Obama, at least to his recollection. And then two, he didn't really care because he said the most important calls were from his dead son's buddies, who he fought alongside with when he died. And so I think for a lot of parents who are grieving at the loss of their, you know, their spouse, their son or daughter, you know, the next of kin, I don't think that all of them necessarily think, oh, you know, my loved one just passed away or just was killed. Will I get a call from the president? I don't think that's really a top priority for them.
I mean, my take on it is what happened is Kelly and Trump had a discussion on it, and Kelly gave him like an honest response to like factually how this is handled. And Trump somehow turned it into an attack on Obama and used it that way. When really, it just was Trump getting an explanation.
It was very inappropriate for him to bring Obama into it.
But I expect the original conversation between him and Kelly was more just a factual, informative conversation, which...
Right, and it's just an indictment on President Trump for how he handles advice from his team. You know, he'll get honest advice, and I think General John Kelly is a genuinely decent man who actually wants to serve his country and actually wants to help this president succeed. And a lot of the times you'll see Trump kind of either dismiss his advice or just go off the cuff because he doesn't like the talking points.
Or totally fail to understand them.
Or fail to understand them, yeah.
And that's when things got truly, I mean, they're already ugly, and it just got uglier from there. And we've been in the muck ever since, pretty much. So that, I think it was that afternoon. And again, there was that whole ridiculous answer Trump gave when he was saying, I wrote letters this weekend, but I'll mail them out today, and I'll call at some point. Like, no, you didn't. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to stuff like that, I don't know why he's even speaking out on it. Because I honestly, like, I don't think anybody was really asking him about this until, like, whether he, what, was it a reporter who asked them if he called?
No. All he was originally asked was, why haven't you spoken about it? He was never asked about his contacts with the family. He was purely asked.
Yeah, and that's what I thought, that he just brought it on,
on his own, and he just felt like bringing this up.
Right.
It was kind of bizarre. Again, that's probably not that unusual here. So he called apparently all four families of the four killed in action at night on October 4th. And one of them was to David Johnson in Miami, and he called as the family was driving to receive his remains at the airport. Now, he actually had, Sergeant Johnson had been part of a mentorship program run by Congresswoman Wilson down in, I think, Miami Gardens. And she knew the family. She was with them, and she was riding with his widow and his mother, the woman who raised him, his mother, effectively. And we had, I guess, probably the casualty officer there who had a phone, and that's when Trump called. We don't know exactly what went down, but, well, apparently it didn't go well. It caused his wife to start crying. His mother says she felt disrespected, and Representative Wilson said that what he told... Well, first of all, it sounded like the whole call was not well scripted. He just kind of rambled. He just talked off the cuff. Didn't know Sergeant Johnson's name and kept calling him your guy. And then said... He knew what he was signing up for, but it still hurts. He knew this could happen when he signed up for it, but it still hurts that it did.
And it's so hard to comment and know with utmost certainty what was said until we actually see like a transcript or recording.
They have a transcript now. Do you see that?
They released a transcript?
No, they gave it to Eric Trump's wife and put her on Fox to talk about it.
Okay, so but we still haven't
seen it. That's bizarre. I don't know what the hell's going on there.
So most of the public has not seen it with fresh eyes, or at least those who are invested in this story or want to learn more about it.
So what we do know is that actually...
At least as of this recording, we have,
yeah,
we have not
seen it. But the press secretary and chief of staff both confirmed Wilson's version of events. So we know that what we do know is that apparently Trump was trying to say a more classic formulation of he knew that there were risks and he bravely did it anyway. And it's tragic.
I have military friends. I don't want to drag my buddy into this, but he fought in Afghanistan and he was injured. He stepped on an IED, lost the lower part of his left leg. And he is a huge Trump critic. And he agreed that, like, yeah, he knew what he signed up. You know, I knew what I signed up for. I'm sure he knew what he signed up for. When you sign up for the military, and again, I've never served. So, I'm only going based off the experience of other people and what they're saying to me, and that they understand the risks of what it means to serve your country. And, you know, I at least understand the context of what General Kelly was saying during that press briefing.
Oh, yes. That, I get what Kelly was saying. You know, what happened, though, is Trump didn't understand the purpose of what is being said, and he totally mangled it in a really kind of atrocious way.
Right. And I know that he basically confirmed what was said, but I understand that, like, you know, Trump saying this, what would have been on script, and it coming up off the script and off the cuff, obviously it doesn't play well. I don't think Trump, in many instances, is very good at being sensitive to...
You mean he has no empathy whatsoever?
I wouldn't say he doesn't have any empathy whatsoever.
Is there a good example of a time he has shown appropriate empathy? Because I'm struggling to think of one.
There was an actual call that just was released by the Washington Post in which he actually called an Army spouse, and it was released through the Washington Post. I mean,
okay, but well, I'm, no, so no, I'm not no, arguing no, that he made Natasha, ruined all the calls. He obviously
it was so, Natasha de Alencar, and it was a call he made in April. For Army Staff Sergeant Mark R. de Alencar, who had been killed in Afghanistan on April 8th. And essentially, the whole recording is there, and you can go and listen to it because you actually get a better sense of, you know, Trump off the cuff actually being sensitive and being empathetic and sympathetic, and him not sounding like an asshole that I think a lot of stories come out to make him look like. And again, I am not saying that he is not an asshole. Pardon my French, of course, to our listeners, but I think there are times when he can absolutely be sympathetic and empathetic. It just doesn't happen with 100% certainty that it's going to happen every time.
You are more rosy on that than I am, but fair enough. And again, but notice they did talk to a bunch of families, and some of them did report that they got calls and appreciated it.
Exactly.
And, that's well.
The thing is, like, this could have just been one horrible call.
Okay, it's not just one, though, because he also called a family and called a father of a man killed in action and randomly offered him $25,000 and then never sent it.
Yeah.
Until the Post called him on it.
By me. Yeah, and I agree.
And that's just gross and weird. I mean, and it's all, it's also like, the fact he gets to talk about that shows how completely inept and terrible he is as a human being and president. But the point being, what upset the family the most, it seems like, is that Trump didn't know the guy's name. He was calling Sergeant Trump's family, and he just called him your guy the whole time, and then made insensitive comments that seemed to be a sort of bastardized version of a more, again, traditional formulation. But saying that he knew what he signed up for has a weird victim-blamey tinge to it.
Now for Bon Appetit. What is it, though? I'm so confused. Like, what the hell is
it? Oh, Bon Appetit. It's a great magazine, actually. And it is beautifully produced. The photographs are gorgeous. And basically, Bon Appetit is like what Pinterest is today, but they did it first, and they did it better.
OG Pinterest?
Now you know how much I think about food, and I have a lifelong love affair with all things related to food, including magazines about food. That's how I know what Bon Appetit is. But since you don't know about it, this is exciting. Maybe this would be a great gift. If there's anybody out there who wants to get Susan a great gift this holiday season, maybe Bon Appetit subscription would be the right gift. Do you cook? Okay. Well, even if you don't cook, you eat. Okay, somebody out there, somebody in your life must cook. But even if you don't cook, I mean, these pictures, believe me, it's a really gorgeous magazine. And it's not just about food. It's where food and culture meets. So Bon Appetit has like cooking and recipes, fashion, travel, design, and more. It's a really cosmopolitan magazine. It's just one of those things that shows you food and culture from all over the world, including like food trends and videos, and there's travel and events. You'd like to drink, right? Look, they've got all.
They also have wine pairings, smoothie recipes, and beer trends for the year.
There you go. See, something for everybody. So we have an exclusive offer for podcast listeners. For a limited time, you can give a subscription to Bon Appetit magazine for $5 off. Susan, I don't know what you're getting for the holiday season. Christmas is here, but it might be a magazine subscription for me, so.
You can get a one-year subscription, an exclusive tote bag, and 6 cookbook PDFs. Or you can get the same with a 2-year subscription to the magazine. And don't forget, there's also a Bon Appetit box available with a bonus issue of the magazine, a Jacques Pepin spatula, Don't Worry, Eat Happy tote bag, and VA chocolate chip toffee recipe card.
Bon Appetit has amazing seasonal recipes and latest food trends in every issue. It's a gift that keeps giving all year long. Plus, you get a really cool Bon Appetit tote bag. It is the perfect gift set for cooks and food lovers in your life. Actually, maybe somebody should give this to me. So use promo code 45 and start shopping now at bonappetit.com/getBA.
The one thing that really bothers me in all of this, and, you know, I know that Congresswoman Frederica Wilson is a family friend of the Johnsons, but, you know, in the private conversation between the president and Maisha Johnson, why do you immediately take that to the press and try to politicize it when you have nothing to gain? All it really does out of that particular situation is try to undermine the president and drag on not only the misery, but the grief that Maisha Johnson has to and her family and her kids have to continue to deal with, because now it's all over the media. We're talking about it right now.
Or that Wilson was upset and talking about it, because this was immediately after she said this. And look, people can disagree whether or not she said what happened, but the point is she accurately described what happened and that she accurately described the family was upset.
It reeks of dirty Washington politics because the one of her comments.
Okay, so that's fine. That can be dirty politics, but like that's not the story here.
Well, that is a story, because if not every army spouse or next of kin reveals a conversation they had with the president and whether he was condescending or he was disrespectful, you know, the fact that a congresswoman was there and immediately tried to find an opportunity to make it a political matter, it sounds like she did, because the response she made to a local affiliate says, you know, she was laughing about how now the White House is following her and now she's a rock star and she has to tell her kids.
Oh, God, wait. That clip you're talking about, the one you think she was being serious about being laughing about that? That was after Kelly attacked her and called her a liar and said some terrible things weren't true about her. And she was telling a story about how she gave that quote about how, like, she was scoffing at the idea of the White House paying attention to her and telling them to buzz off, basically. She was not laughing at the White House. Like, dude, why would she be excited or be a rock star to have the chief of staff call her like a disgusting liar?
You tell me. I mean, I don't know why.
Because she was scoffing at it. The whole story was that she was saying, like, why is the White House really paying attention
cared,
to me?
If she really cared about this family and not her own profile, I think she would have handled it much differently.
So you don't like her tone? Like, the president's lied repeatedly, and we're talking about a congresswoman's tone?
It's the fact that she went immediately to the press after this conversation with between Trump and Maisha Johnson.
So, okay, so why is it okay for one family to release a call that Trump gave, but not for them?
No, I'm not saying it's not inappropriate. I'm saying the immediate politics of it and the attempt to politicize a soldier's death is what I have a problem with.
No, but it was already politicized by Trump himself unnecessarily and repeatedly. The fact that, I mean, why shouldn't she say, I mean, the point is he
made
her cry.
First of all, do we even know if Maisha Johnson gave Congresswoman Wilson permission to speak out on the matter?
Yeah, it seems like it. And the mother.
Seems like it, like, you know, with 100% certainty that she gave her permission?
The mother did. I don't remember seeing an exact quote from the wife.
Okay.
But the family did.
Okay, but the mother was not actually a part of that conversation. She was listening.
Yes, she was.
In.
She was there.
Was she speaking on the phone with Trump?
Yeah, she was in the limo.
No, she was. She was on. Okay, Trump was on the speakerphone in the limo with Maisha Johnson, Johnson's mother, and the congresswoman.
Yes.
That conversation was meant to be private between the president and next of kin.
I think the real point is, though, I just don't think Trump, you know, he probably said it in a way that was misconstrued. I don't think he said anything wrong in the call.
Okay, well, it doesn't matter. At this point, it actually kind of doesn't matter what he said, because what did happen is the wife took the wrong way and started crying. And the fact he didn't know the guy's name, I think that is wrong. That he should have at least been prepped on that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that.
So whatever. What happens next is a disgrace. I mean, you can disagree on the fact that she decided to talk about it, but Trump then falsely goes on Twitter and accuses both Congresswoman Wilson and, by implication, the wife of the soldier killed in action, of lying about what happened in the phone call, and claimed he had proof they were lying.
Yeah, like, no, I mean, the thing is, well, obviously he has proof of it, because they take every phone call.
No, but again, his proof that, not proof they're lying, because again, both press secretary and Kelly have confirmed the version of events given by Wilson and the wife and Sergeant Johnson's mother. So Trump was lying when he accused them of lying. And that's horrible. Like, that's a fucking disgrace. My God, who accuses a war widow of lying about a phone call when she was absolutely telling the truth?
Well, but Trump could have said it better. But I think his point was that, you know, I was not trying to be as callous as I'm being presented to be.
But he didn't say that. He accused them of lying. Like, he could have easily said that. Instead, he doubled down on a crazy story to try and attack. And here's the thing for me. Like, okay, all this may have been misunderstanding, but at no point has anyone in the White House apologized for what they'd caused to Maisha Johnson. Like, they've never said, I'm sorry that I'm sorry that I didn't convey it in an effective way. I'm sorry that this is how you interpret it. Here's what I meant. There's never been an acknowledgement that she understood it as disrespect and she understood it as upsetting. And that's true. Like, that's not a thing. You can't be like, I didn't mean it that way, so she can't be upset. Like, you apologize and move on. Dear God.
No, I agree. I mean, he should have apologized for what he said and not remembering LaDavid Johnson's name. And if he conveyed disrespect, he should have owned up to it. I agree. I mean, his handling of the phone call afterwards was terrible. And I don't think Trump deserved the defense that General Kelly gave him, because if Kelly had made that phone call, because he knows from experience, because his son was killed in Afghanistan in 2010.
Yeah.
His first bit of advice was to not call, because there's nothing.
He knew that Trump couldn't handle it. He absolutely should never have called.
There was nothing that Trump or any president could have done to make that situation better. And now here we are.
He couldn't offer $25,000.
Well, I mean, I don't know where the $25,000 came out of and what inspired him to just be like, here you go. Here's $25,000. Because, you know, every, you know, the next of kin, the person that is listed on the soldier's forms, you know, they receive money from the government to, I guess,
it's just weird and gross and bizarre. And
right. And there are no winners. I mean, it's just a reminder that there's no winners in this. And it's never appropriate on both sides to politicize the death of a soldier, because, you know, we saw what happened between Trump and the Khans in 2016. Now we're seeing how both the Johnsons are being treated and how John Kelly is being treated, because remember, he's a Gold Star parent too.
Mm-hmm. And yet he's letting himself be, when that speech, the press conference he gave, and he attacked Wilson for bringing us up, it's ignoring the fact that Trump is the one who brought it up, started and kept it going, and repeatedly lied about it.
She's politicizing.
Yeah, I don't think Wilson, I think,
who cares? The president lying repeatedly about a Gold Star family, you're constantly saying
this isn't the story. It further prolongs the story for Wilson to come forward and reveal that information. She did not have to.
How bad would it have to be before you feel like it's appropriate or acceptable or not wrong for a congressman to say the president, in his ineptitude, forgot the war dad's name and then made his widow cry? Like, how bad does that have to be before you're allowed to talk
about
that?
She's misrepresenting it.
Well, she's not. But she understands it the same way the family did. Look, I do agree. Trump was probably meeting the classic formulation and he screwed it up. But that's how they heard it. There's one more point to bring up here in that bizarre press conference Kelly gave. Not only did he attack Wilson, he also lied about her. Or not probably lied, probably just totally misremembered. And claimed some story about how she'd bragged about getting money for a building at a dedication and called her an empty barrel. Turns out that's not true. She was actually the one who got the building dedicated to two FBI agents who are apparently legends in the community. And that's what she spoke about at the dedication. But all that aside, there was a very weird segue in Kelly's press conference. Did y'all hear the part about his lamenting that things weren't like the Leave It to Beaver days anymore?
You mean about what's held sacred and what's not? Yeah, I heard. Listened to that.
And when he died, in the four cases we're talking about, Niger, my son's case in Afghanistan, when he died, he was surrounded by the best men on this earth, his friends. That's what the president tried to say to four families the other day. I was stunned when I came to work yesterday morning and brokenhearted at what I saw a member of Congress doing. A member of Congress who listened in on a phone call from the President of the United States to a young wife, and in his way tried to express that opinion. He's a brave man, a fallen hero. He knew what he was getting himself into because he enlisted. There's no reason to enlist. He enlisted. And he was where he wanted to be, exactly where he wanted to be, with exactly the people he wanted to be with when his life was taken. That was the message. That was the message that was transmitted. It stuns me that a member of Congress would have listened in on that conversation. Absolutely stuns me. And I thought, at least that was sacred. You know, when I was a kid growing up, a lot of things were sacred in our country. Women were sacred and looked upon with great honor. That's obviously not the case anymore, as we see from recent cases. Life, the dignity of life, was sacred. That's gone. Religion, that seems to be gone as well. Gold Star families, I think that left in the convention over the summer. But I just thought,
the selfless devotion that brings a man or woman to die on the battlefield. I just thought that that might be sacred.
And I gotta say, that was bizarre and upsetting to hear someone in the White House say. And it tells you exactly where Kelly's coming from and exactly who he is. And he has a...
So who is Kelly?
Someone who has a very retrograde view of women. The fact that he thinks that women had it better in the 1950s, or that the way women were treated was better then, that's
well, maybe, not... I don't necessarily think that's what he was saying. I think he was just talking to a better sense of national unity and...
Women were sacred. How is that unity, though? Like, he said women, when I was a kid growing up, women were treated with like they were sacred and viewed with honor.
What's wrong with that?
Because that's not an equal human being. Why would you say a woman is sacred? Are men not sacred? Should men not be viewed with honor? It's not honor. It's being viewed as a lesser being.
The thing is, like, that the definition has changed. Now, it seems nowadays that only men are viewed with honor and women are not. And maybe that's what he was trying to say is that, well, I mean, like, if you look at society right now, almost...
Are men sacred?
No, men aren't sacred. I don't think anyone's sacred.
He said women were sacred in the 50s.
That's what you're saying. That's what I said.
No, that's what he said. I'm asking if you agree that women are sacred or were sacred, but no longer are.
No, I think the way that society has treated women has gotten progressively worse.
Whoa, since the 50s?
Well, if not worse, then at least more in the spotlight. And maybe that's...
Jesus. Okay, as a woman, I'm just going to say full on, that's completely wrong. Because I have abilities to interact with the world now that I never would have had even decades ago. My ability to be in the world and be a co-equal human being, I mean, it's not perfect now, but it's far surpassing what it would have been 30, 40 years ago.
Standard of living has gotten much better for both genders. And then if you want to include transgender and not, you know, non-binary. LGBT. Yeah, LGBTQ. Obviously, those have gotten much better. But I think the way that society as a whole continues to treat men, women, LGBTQ is still not where it needs to be.
Sure, I'm not going to disagree there.
And
'50s is definitely not an improvement over the current situation.
I think he's really. I just think we're completely overanalyzing this, and like I think what he's talking about there is like, you know, opening doors for women and stuff. Old school kind of, you know,
chivalry,
military chivalry style is chivalry.
It's probably the chivalry that
formality,
he's thinking of.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not...
If that's what he's, like, worried about, then that's a weird segue to get into. Like, no one holds doors open anymore for women.
I mean, I do.
I mean, also, it's not true, because they do. And in Virginia, I hate the South, because, like, the elevator thing is the worst. Like, you're the only woman in the group trying to get on an elevator. Everyone has to stop and awkwardly let you get on first. So that part of chivalry can die.
I spent many years saying, I really don't care what I'm wearing on the inside of my clothes. Who cares? But... I had a friend who like kind of changed my mind on that, and then it really did change my outlook, because good underwear really does help you feel confident, good, ready to conquer the world all day. And we have a sponsor this week that, I mean, there's some of the most comfortable undies I've kind of ever tried, and it's called Me Undies.
They have a ton of different colors and styles to fit whatever you prefer. Boy shorts, bikini, thongs, something for everyone.
I personally like mama underwear that goes like all the way up. But anyway, the point is, MeUndies has lots of different amazing options to choose from and lots of different colors too. You've got solids, patterns, brights, even laces, really cute stuff. Every mood, every occasion. And once you guys feel MeUndies for yourself, you will love them because they are really, really comfortable and touchable, and really they'll keep you confident and comfortable all day. Plus, they've got 100% satisfaction guarantee. They guarantee you will love your undies or you get your money back.
So right now, MeUndies has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get 20% off your first pair and free shipping. MeUndies is so sure that you'll love their underwear, they even offer a 100% satisfaction guarantee. You order a pair, and if you don't love the first one, you get a full refund.
And by the way, they don't just have underwear for ladies. We're talking about guys' underwears too, for everybody in your life. Don't just get it for yourself. So it's a no-brainer to try. 20% off, free shipping, and 100% satisfaction guarantee. What are you waiting for?
To get your 20% off, free shipping, and the 100% satisfaction guarantee, and to get the best and softest underwear you will ever own, go to MeUndies.com/45th. That's MeUndies.com/45th.
It's a limited time offer, so what are you waiting for? Start wearing the best underwear of your life and get it for the people you love. Go to MeUndies.com/45th today, right now.
All right, so let's talk about something else. So you had this story on Trump interviewing New York attorney generals.
Did y'all hear about this? So there's just a weird series of content. Like, So the DOJ, Department of Justice, it is, you know, a federal agency. It is under the president. But there has always been a division there. Sessions is currently the head of the DOJ, and he does work with Trump. There is interaction there. But especially with regards to either A, individual prosecutions, or B, individual attorney generals, they don't interact with the president for good reason. They usually, it's an appearance issue. You just want to avoid any appearance of impropriety of the president, like, influencing a prosecution or a president being personally involved in the decision to prosecute a U.S. citizen or anyone. And in this case, it seems to be even beyond just appearances, but actual substantive influence going on. And it's pretty disturbing. And now this goes back to the Preet Bharara thing. Do y'all remember that?
Yeah. So he fired, he was a U.S. attorney.
Yeah.
So representing the federal government for the state of New York. Fired him because, was it the travel ban?
Well, he fired all of them at once, but it came like the day after he made a call to him. And Preet Bharara was like, well, this is improper and shouldn't happen. I don't know what to do. So he did not return the call. And the next day, Trump fired all of them.
It was in relation to the travel ban, was it not?
No, it could have been, but it doesn't seem, they claim it's just a coincidence, really, the timing. But he had previously told Bharara that he wanted him to stay on. And the reason all this matters is that this week it came out that Trump personally interviewed potential U.S. attorneys for New York districts, which is the home state of Trump, obviously. And we're currently, not only is there sort of ongoing investigations into Trump's associates, but if you're breaching the lines, investigations into Trump himself. These would be the U.S. attorneys that would prosecute Trump if anything came to the investigations.
All right. So I'm not so familiar with New York state law, but are attorney generals in the state of New York treated as an elected official? Because at least...
No, this is federal. This is federal.
Federal. Okay. All right. So it's within the Department of Justice and it'd be a U.S. attorney.
So there's two districts there. I believe it was the Southern District. So there's basically the two U.S. attorneys that would be in charge of these cases, like previously Preet Bharara was. And this would be things not related to, like, the Russia investigation. Well, it could be that, but mostly it'd be stuff about Trump Tower and money laundering and all the stuff that Trump and his family's gotten up to. So the president don't interview people directly. They appoint them. But what they don't ever do before is to find people from law firms of their close confidants and interview them for the job of possibly prosecuting you. So it's kind of, it seems like sort of a small story, I guess, but to me, this is huge and a serious threat to rule of law in our nation if this is just kind of going on unchecked.
So what is it that, and you think it actually has a direct tie to the Russian investigation? Or do you
No. So it wouldn't be actually directly, I mean, actually, we know that the grand jury is in D.C.
Right.
But everything else that Trump's done, like Trump Tower, Trump organization, jurisdiction over those kind of offenses would likely be in these districts.
So you're talking about anything that he's done in the state of New York from, you know, when he is president from, you know, from this year on. So like nothing previously is what?
No, previous stuff. Definitely okay. Previous stuff.
Because, just to push back on it, because if he is appointing, and you know, this goes to the Department of Justice traditionally in terms of interviewing candidates for being, you know, appointed by the president. Even if the U.S. attorney have found something that was possibly criminal against President Trump, the likelihood of that coming to fruition through the Department of Justice, controlled by Jeff Sessions, thereby controlled by President Trump, are highly unlikely.
I mean, in practical terms now, yes. But in how it's supposed to work, how it's traditionally worked, no.
Right. I mean, justice should be blind. But as we, you know, as we all know, agencies like the DOJ get politicized all the time.
That's why they've worked so hard to try and fight back against that and not allow this. Like, it is super, super inappropriate for the president to even call the U.S. attorney. And he was doing that before. Now he's interviewing them closely. There's just no reason for, there isn't a reason for Trump to do this. There's no good reason. There's no reason that isn't shady as heck.
Yeah, it comes off as shady.
And but corrupt until,
but
and
until
scary.
There's a there.
So that's where Preet Bharara comes in. If you read between the lines stuff he said, and he was the previous U.S. attorney there, it seems like there was possibly an ongoing investigation going when he was fired. And There's concern. That's why he was calling. That's why he wouldn't return the call, in part. He felt it was inappropriate to return the call to someone he was investigating.
What do we know about this potential investigation?
Not much, because they're pretty tight-lipped about it. But there's a lot of signs that there are money laundering investigations ongoing in New York right now. We know that New York State is actually involved with Mueller in the Manafort money laundering stuff. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I do think a lot of the Russian stuff, where Russian, you know, intelligence goes, you know, the Russian mafia goes, and you know, obviously there's a lot of opportunity to launder money in New York City. So, you know, I do think stuff will come out of that. But at this point,
do you think there's a there?
Yeah, I do.
But the money laundering? Yeah.
I think there's a limit, you know, what we can say about this, though, because, of course, well, we don't know.
Right. It's all speculation at this point.
I mean, Trump Soho. It was money laundering. Wow. I'm happy to go on the record with that.
I mean, it would be surprising if it wasn't money laundering. But, you know, I can't say for the utmost certainty that, you know, we know.
Look, that mayor in Kazakhstan just really wanted a bunch of, like, multimillion dollar condos.
What happened?
he was money laundering his, because he was a mayor of the capital of Kazakhstan, and he used that money to buy a bunch of towers in Trump Soho, a bunch of condos.
Now, what about cost sharing reductions? Let's go on to that.
Oh, I think that, there was a bipartisan deal between Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander in the Senate, and Trump now seems to be on board with that.
But is he? But, like, cause I feel like every 5 minutes this changes, and I am very confused about where he is from one minute to the next. He was, and he wasn't, and he was.
The jury's still out on whether he actually knows what's going on. I think the initial move to end cost-sharing reductions was a good thing to incentivize insurance companies to lower premiums. Of course.
Whoa, you think it's a good thing?
Like, hold on. You didn't let me explain. I'm saying, of course, there's a potential for it to backfire, and insurance companies could raise premiums. But there was never an incentive under Obamacare to lower insurance premiums because all they were getting was a gravy train of taxpayer money. So if you are getting that much money, why should you ever lower premiums?
Wait, but so now the U.S. government's going to pay $200 billion more, and premiums are still going to go up
lot. But
it's a way of pushing Democrats into a reform process.
Yeah.
By hurting everyone?
Well, I mean, by introducing market forces that weren't there before to try and show the proper and more accurate costing of healthcare consumption in the country.
So first, their version, their story behind this was not that. Their story is actually that, oh, it's a legal matter. We believe under the Constitution we shouldn't do this.
It is. The cost sharing reductions were ruled as unconstitutional by a D.C. district court.
It's a complicated issue. That part is complicated, and ongoing litigation is not, like, there. So I'm not taking a position one way or another.
Well, the reason it's unconstitutional is because President Obama tried to go through appropriations in 2013 through Congress, and Congress denied him. And so he said, I'm just going to go ahead and do it anyway. It's shifting the balance of powers to where he was becoming the legislator and not Congress. And therefore, that's why it was held unconstitutional.
By a lower court. So we need several more rounds of appeals here to determine constitutionality of that. And it's an interesting question in its own right. But the point was, that's the reason that Trump put forth why he did this. Of course, everyone knows in reality that's just a cover for him trying to be a dick to everyone and cause enough pain where he can force to get his way. Now, do you think it's an appropriate motivation for a president to... I mean, the money alone, like, seriously, there's no one wins here. Like, government pays more, people pay more. No one wins. It just causes more loss.
Status quo. But it's going to push Democrats to the table to do healthcare reform. So this is not
by blowing up everything. I mean, that's his usual.
I mean, he wants Obamacare to fail, and so pushing.
But he also has a duty to faithfully execute the laws
and
that exist.
As it currently stands, the cost sharing reductions are ruled as unconstitutional. So
no, that's not enforced right now. That was suspended pending further appeal. So that's not. There's no legal argument there in terms of the courts. That's still to be worked out. And I don't know what's going to happen. That's going to be a messy, messy appeal. I don't know what they're going to do to handle that.
Yeah, but I mean, he's basically playing Obama's same game, right? That he's using executive power to, you know, pursue his own political interests. So, I mean, I don't think there's any...
By harming everyone and costing hundreds of billions of dollars in loss. I mean, if you think it's acceptable, I guess I can't argue with your beliefs, but I have a huge problem with that being his tactic when, in fact, his party controls everything.
He's removing a government entitlement and putting in a more accurate measure of how much healthcare costs. So, I mean,
everyone's paying more though. Like, it doesn't help anyone. It just hurts. It's causing pain for political purpose.
In the longer term, Obamacare is not going to bend the cost curve. We need healthcare reform that does. So in the longer term, I think it will help people.
That's a real ends justify the means kind of argument, though. Like, how much pain can it cause in the goal of wanting... He thinks healthcare costs $1 a month. So he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. Which, again, I don't understand why we're still talking about having healthcare reform when the president thinks healthcare costs $1 a month. Clearly, we're not in a place as a society to really rethink these issues.
Well, I've never really thought of President Trump as a policy buff when it comes to healthcare.
But it's so absurd to think that someone who has zero conception of how healthcare actually works is now supposedly breaking the system to achieve a goal that he can't articulate and couldn't understand if someone explained it to him.
And there's also, you know, there's also the possibility that Trump is just looking for a win any way he possibly can, and that he's going to these measures in order to do it.
Can we just all agree to tell him that Obamacare is gone and pretend that it is and nothing changes? And then he'd shut up.
I mean,
I'm kidding. So again, but point is, things do need to change, which is why there was a bipartisan effort that was underway in the past week. And Trump has really, I think it's probably like 4 or 5 times now, he's gone back and forth. It's really unclear how he feels.
Yeah, I don't know how he currently feels. And, you know, I guess we'll wait and see what Congress actually does when everyone's back in town. But, I mean, they're trying to prioritize tax reform. That's something that he seems to be most passionate about. And I guess we'll see where the debate goes on that.
Did you know the estate tax doesn't benefit just the wealthy, apparently?
I guess.
Well, thanks for joining us this week on the 45th. And we'll be back next week to cover everything that's gone on in the Trump administration.
Big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.